Our speaker is Mladen Bezvina. He's one of my favorite mathematicians and one of the few I would pay to go listen to. I'm also grateful to him when I was stuck on a problem I've been working on for years on the Oregon coast. We had gone there to go to the beach, and the rains and the wind came, and so we were chased indoors, and he supplied the missing link in a proof of something that I wanted very much to prove. So I'm very appreciative. Mladen is going to tell us about outer space, and from Thurston and on from now.
Thank you, Jim. That was very kind. I know by now it might sound like a stereotype, but I really appreciate the invitation to speak at this conference, so thank you, organizers, and it's a great honor. My goal for the next hour is to try to paint a picture of where we are in the study of the geometry of automorphisms of free groups and the enormous influence of Thurston on the subject. So let me start by what I think of as the defining moment. Just to set some notation and to wake up or whatever. And thank you all for coming after the hard work last night. I should say that too. Okay, so if you've never seen an automorphism of a free group, then it's about time to see one, and here. So a free group is just given by some letters, like A and B, and the capital letters are the inverses, and then the automorphism is defined like that. You're given a couple of words in A's and B's. And then what you notice is that there is no cancellation when you multiply A and B, but if you do it to F of A and F of B, then there is cancellation. In this case, two of the letters will cancel. Let me try this. Right, so this B will cancel with that B, and this A will then cancel with that A. Okay, so then you might wonder whether you can come up with examples like this where you see more than two letters, or can you see 1,000 letters canceling? Okay, so that's to state the theorem, the notation here is just that this bracket notation is to the canceled word, the reduced word that's equivalent to the word X. And then here is Thurston's bounded cancellation level. Okay, so for every automorphism F, you can find a constant C that depends only on this automorphism and nothing else, so that whenever you have reduced words, U, V, and U times V. Okay, so you have to set it up so that there's no cancellation between U and V. Then you apply F to this, then there's a bound on how many letters are going to cancel between F of U and F of V. Or in terms of a picture, you think about F as being some kind of a map from the Cayley tree to the Cayley tree. And then this condition that U, V, and U, V are reduced words amounts to saying that U is on the line segment between the identity and U times V. When you apply F, then of course F of U may not be on the line segment between 1 and F of U, V. But it's at most distance C from it. Okay, that's the restatement of the bounded cancellation lemma. C depends on the automorphism, which of course remembers what n is. Okay, now the proof of this is not very difficult, and I will give you a proof. Okay, so there are three steps, and somehow the proof is very easy because today the ingredients are very much ingrained in the subject. So, but words like quasi-isometries were not available easily in those days. So there are three steps. The first step is that this automorphism is a quasi-isometry from the free group to itself. Where in fact, it's even better. It's a bi-Lipschitz isomorphism. Bi-Lipschitz equivalence. The second thing is you have to know that quasi-isometries send geodesics to quasi-geodesics. So this is almost by definition. And then the third ingredient, which is non-trivial, although in the case of trees, it's easily proved, is that quasi-geodesics in trees, or more generally, Gromov hyperbolic spaces, are going to stay in Hausdorff neighborhoods of geodesics connecting their endpoints. Okay, so here is my automorphism F, and I take my segment here. The image is going to be some kind of a finite subtree. But the path that's traversed by, if I take f of this path that I see here, well, that's going to be some kind of a path. That path is a quasi-geodesic, and it has to stay in a definite Hausdorff neighborhood of the geodesic connecting the endpoints. And that finishes the proof. Okay. So the next contribution, the big contribution of Bill Thurston, is to the theory of train tracks. He invented them. And here is the definition. So what is a train track structure on a graph? Okay, so he usually considered train tracks on surfaces, but here we'll just look at graphs by themselves. So we have a graph such as this one. This is just a wedge of two circles. And the train track structure on this graph is a collection of two element subsets of the link. Those are also called turns. So if I give you two points in the link, that's called a turn. Okay? So some of those are singled out, and they're called legal turns. And in the picture, I blew up this vertex, the yellow vertex, to a yellow disk. And then I connected the link, the pairs of points in the link that are called legal. So there are four points in the link. And you know, these two form a legal turn. These two form a legal turn, and these two form a legal. So there are three legal turns in this graph. Okay? So that's the definition of a train track structure. And here's a quotation from one of, maybe this is from the notes, I'm not sure. The mental image is that of a railroad switch, or more generally, a switchyard, where for each incoming direction, there is a set of possible outgoing directions where trains can be diverted without reversing course. Okay, so in other words, you're supposed to think about a train running around here, but when the train comes to this yellow disk, it has to follow one of these legal turns. And so from here, it's allowed to go either to this point in the link and exit, or to this one, but it's not allowed to go over here. Yes? For now, it can. When you prove a theorem, you have to do. You have to say something. But for now, this is a good definition. Okay. Here is a much better picture, due to Conan Wu. It's a train track on a twice punctured torus. Okay. Now here are some more definitions. Okay, so we'll say that the path is legal if it is a local embedding. In other words, it's an immersion, it doesn't backtrack. And when it goes through a vertex, it goes through it in a legal way. Okay, so that's the... And then a self-map of a graph is a train track map if it satisfies the following equivalent conditions. So one way to say it is that if you take any edge in the graph and you start iterating it, those iterates will never backtrack. Okay, that's maybe the easiest way to say it. Although that condition is hard to check. And so the equivalent condition is that there is a train track structure, there exists a train track structure that's preserved by the map. And that'll be hard if you start with a complete graph. So what that means is that all legal paths have to be mapped to legal paths. If you declare edges are mapped to legal. I want edges to be mapped to legal paths and legal turns to be mapped to legal turns. So I guess I want iterates of edges not to backtrack either. Okay, so think of. What's that? Anyway, so I want edges to be mapped to legal paths and legal turns to be mapped to legal turns. F is, should be G. G.
G applied.
G applied k times. Okay, now this is a picture drawn by me. Okay, so here, so this is an example of a train track map. Okay, so the train track structure we had on the first slide is in fact preserved by this map. If you look at, for example, so where does A go? Well, first of all, A goes to AAB. So it's A, and then capital B means B inverse. And so that transition, so you can go from A to A, and you can also go from A to B inverse. That's all legal. And you can check the other conditions as well. Okay, so this is now time to tell sort of personal story. So so this was 1987, and I came to the Institute for Advanced Study for a year, and there was this other topologist there at the Institute whose name was Michael Handel, and we both went to Thurston's class, and there were all kinds of interesting people there. I met Dick and Yair and Rick and Rich. I guess I knew Rich from before. And there was Kurt sitting in the front row. And I remember the first class, Thurston walks in and says, give me a group. And I know somebody would give him a group, and he would proceed to draw the Cayley graph of that group. And the whole hour was like that. And it was hard to predict what was going to happen the next class. But it was always interesting, and there were these very lively discussions in the class. And so then eventually, Michael and I decided that we should work on something, so we went to Bill and asked him, what should we work on? And he said, you should prove that automorphisms of free groups are represented by train track maps. And we had access to Daryl Cooper's notes from some previous class, where Thurston, instead of asking, give me a group, he presumably was asking, give me an automorphism. And he would proceed to work out the train track representative for an automorphism. Anyway, we were good students, I guess, and we ended up, by the end of the semester, we proved this theorem that fully irreducible automorphisms can be represented by train track maps. It's not quite true that every automorphism can be represented by a train track map. Okay, so fully reducible here means that no proper free factor is periodic up to conjugation. So that's kind of like saying if you have a surface automorphism, you don't want any periodic subsurface. Okay, so why do you like to have train track maps? So here we'll actually consider a little more general train track maps rather than those that come from fully reducible automorphisms. The definition is that there are no homotopically proper G-invariant subgraphs. So those are called irreducible train track maps. So who knows? Maybe the automorphism that this train track map represents is not fully reducible. In other words, when you take a power, or even it might not even be irreducible. But at least it looks irreducible. From this train track representative looks irreducible. There are no obvious invariant or periodic free factors. So then, what you can do is you can assign a metric so that to the graph, in other words, a number, a length to every edge, so that every legal path is stretched by the same factor lambda. So, for example, in this you would look at this transition matrix. You would look at how many times does A go over A? Well, twice. And you don't pay any attention to orientation. So how many times does A go over B? Well, once. So that's the first column is 2, 1. And then you can work out from the Perron-Frobenius theory what these lengths should be. And then every legal path gets stretched by that same amount. And that lambda is the growth rate of an automorphism. If you take a typical conjugacy class, or even any conjugacy class that doesn't happen to be periodic, then it's going to grow at that rate, lambda. And one of the features of this lambda is that it's a weak Perron number. In other words, it's greater than or equal than any of its Galois conjugates. Okay, so that's the definition of a weak Perron number. It's an algebraic integer, and it's greater than or equal than any of its Galois conjugates. Fully reducible does, but if I, In other words, I'm allowing a power not to be reducible. And the reason is, you'll see on the next slide. Okay, so here are some more examples of train track maps. The first one is essentially the same, except for changing the orientation of one of the edges. But this is the second one. They don't have to be roses like they are in this picture, wedges of circles. They could be more complicated graphs. But this is how you the second one doesn't have a consistent orientation like the first one, and you can see how you can work out what the value of lambda is. You know, you decide that maybe the length of A should be 1. And then the length of B has to be lambda because F stretches by a factor of lambda, and so on. And then you get these equations, and in the end you get a polynomial equation that lambda has to satisfy. Now, in these examples, you'll notice that the constant term is 1. In other words, these are algebraic integers that are units. And here's a picture from Thurston's last paper. It's an example of an automorphism where this lambda is 3. And I've never seen before such an example where lambda is an integer. This does not happen for automorphisms of surfaces. Those are always units. There were examples before of automorphisms whose growth rates were not algebraic units by Gaborio and Levite. But I've never seen before this, you know, an actual integer like 3. Okay, and then Thurston in this paper proves the following theorem, that every weak Perron number lambda, such as 3, there is an irreducible train track map with dilatation lambda. So this is for this I want. That's why I wanted to allow this weak. So for example, square root of 2. Is a weak Perron number, but it's not a Perron number. Yes?
I can't tell just by looking at that picture that map was invertible. Is it?
That's not trivial, but you can. There's an algorithm to find out, yeah.
But your train track maps are invertible.
They don't have to be, but if you study automorphisms, they will be invertible. Yes, that's right. Yeah. So this one is invertible. This one is invertible.
Circle wrapping around itself 3 times.
3 times. That's right. That's not invertible. Yes, but that's not an automorphism, right? Exactly. Okay, so there are questions that Thurston was thinking about. So I mean, there's you want to do the same thing for surface automorphisms. What is the characterization of growth rates for pseudo-anisotropies? And there's Fried's conjecture, which says that it's those lambdas so that all the Galois conjugates are in the annulus of radius lambda and 1/lambda. But that's not known. And then in the out FN world, you want to know so the growth rate of F is typically different from the growth rate of F inverse, unlike in the surface case. And you really want to characterize the pairs that occur. And as far as I know, the conjecture is there's no obstruction. So the conjecture is presumably that any pair of weak Perron numbers occurs. Okay. Fried's conjecture is that for pseudo-anisotropies, all the Galois conjugates have to be contained in the annulus determined by lambda and 1/lambda. Okay. It's clearly necessary. Yes, clearly necessary, and then the conjecture is that any such lambda in fact occurs. Okay, so then the next topic is mapping tori and 3-manifolds. Okay, so if I have a homotopy equivalence on the graph, I can form a mapping torus. So here it is. You just take the product of the graph with the 0, 1, and then you glue the top to the bottom using this G, map G from gamma to gamma. And then the fundamental group of the mapping torus is going to be the semi-direct product, the free group in Z. And so we'll call it the mapping torus of F. And the principle here is that these groups look just like 3-manifold groups. They're not 3-manifold groups, but they have many similar features. For example, a group is called coherent if every... A group is coherent if every finitely generated subgroup is finitely presented. And of course, the classical theorem of Peter Scott is that that every three-manifold group is coherent. And then Fain and Hendel proved that the same is true for these mapping tori of automorphisms. Now, here is a famous theorem of Bill Thurston. If you take a Sudanasov homeomorphism of a surface, and here I actually stated it by saying that there are no periodic isotopic classes of essential simple closed curves, which is of course equivalent to saying that that F is Sudanasov, then the mapping torus is a hyperbolic three manifold, and this is a picture of from one of Bill's papers. It's an approximation to the Cannon-Thurston map, the map from the circle. The boundary of the hyperbolic plane, which is the fiber, to the boundary of the hyperbolic three manifold, which is the two sphere.
Isn't that Sullivan's theorem? That is definitely Sullivan's theorem.
Okay, and then there are corresponding theorems for out of n. Okay, so if f is an automorphism that does not have any non-trivial periodic conjugacy classes, then this semi-direct product is Gromov hyperbolic. Now here, there is a distinction between automorphisms that don't have periodic conjugacy classes. Those are called atoroidal, and the fully reducible automorphism. So in the surface category, those two notions are the same. But in out of N, they're not. And this really is a strictly larger class, the ones that are atoroidal. So Mark and I did the fully reducible case, and then Brinkman extended it to this general case later. So the if there's no year, that means it was a long time ago. Sorry. and then there's this recent theorem of Mark Hagen and Danny Wise that in fact these groups can all be cubulated, and so by Hagel and Wise they're linear groups, which I find amazing. There is no reason why these groups... In fact, in the early days, these groups were sort of candidates for being delta hyperbolic, but not cat 0 or cat minus 1.
I think it needs to be fully irreducible.
What's that?
They're considered fully irreducible.
No. They have a more general version a few weeks ago. The subject changes rapidly. And then there's a companion theorem, which also doesn't have a year attached to it. But if you take any automorphism, not necessarily reducible, atoroidal, whatever, then this mapping torus satisfies quadratic isoperimetric inequality. Okay, well, here's another recent development. So the classical theorem of Thurston is that if you take a hyperbolic three-manifold and you look at the first cohomology, so this is some first cohomology with coefficients in Z. Well, that's some kind of a lattice in the vector space. Then there is a collection of cones. And this cartoon suggests that these cones are symmetric in the origin. So that if you take a point in the cone, that's going to correspond to an integral cohomology class. It's represented by a fibration, represented by a map from the three manifold to the circle, which is a fibration. And then there are through companion results, there is a theorem of Fried, which says that you can wonder about the dilatation. If I pick one of these points in the cone, well then I'll have a monodromy of that vibration, and then there's some lambda that comes with that, and so for every point in this cone I get some lambda. And so I can try to understand all these lambdas at the same time. Can I understand them all at the same time? And so Fried's theorem is that there is a function that's defined on the whole cone, which is continuous, homogeneous of degree minus one, defined on the whole cone, so that on these integral points, it evaluates to log lambda, where lambda is the dilatation. And then there is a theorem of McMullen that says that in fact you can this function is defined by a finite amount of data. There's an element of this group ring, Z of the first homology of the manifold. So this is some finite integral combination of elements of the first homology that recovers all these lambdas. So if I give you a cohomology class in one of these cones, then I can push this theta to Z of Z. So the cohomology class maps first homology to Z, and so I will get an element of Z, which is a polynomial. And then I can take the house. The house is the largest root of that polynomial. So take the norm of the largest root of that polynomial, and that's the dilatation. Okay. So this finite amount of data tells you about all of the lambdas in that cone. And then the recent development is that in fact the same holds for out Fn. There are some caveats and so on, and I won't really get into it. But you, for example, these cones are no longer symmetric with respect to the origin. And there are these papers that appeared in the last year or so due to two groups of people. There is Dowdall, Kapovich, Leininger, and Algonquier, Hironaka, and Rafi. And about half of them are here. Okay, so I won't go through these words, but it is the same theorem, modulo some of these caveats. And I should also mention that there is an older work of Beery, Norman, and Strable that implies, for example, that these, there are open sets, for example, the set of points that belong to these Cs. Okay, so now. Now we go on to outer space. Okay, so I'll start by defining it, although I'm sure most of you have seen it. Okay, so a graph here is just going to be a finite one-dimensional complex, but the vertices, we are not allowing vertices of valence 1 and 2. And then the rows is a wedge of circles. A marking is a homotopy equivalent. So normally, I like the marking to go from the rows to the graph. But today, it's reversed. So the homotopy equivalence goes from this graph to the rows. And you're supposed to think about collapsing one of these edges. So the labeling defines the homotopy equivalence. You collapse the unlabeled edges. That's supposed to form a maximal tree in that graph. And then these labels tell you where to send the other edges around the rows. And then what's a metric on the graph? Well, it's an assignment of positive lengths to the edges of gamma, so that the sum is 1. Okay, so that's a metric. Those are the kinds of metrics we. So this definition is modeled on the definition of Teichmuller space. So we're looking at objects equipped with some metric structure. And in this case, it's graphs with a metric. Okay, so the definition, due to Kahler and Volkmann, is that outer space is the space of equivalence classes of these marked metric graphs. So you have sort of the usual picture where you have it's a pair, G gamma, and two of these are equivalent if there's an isometry from one to the other that makes this diagram commute. And what you're supposed to pay attention to is that there are different kind of labelings of the graph that define the same point in outer space, the same marked graph. So here, if you collapse this edge in the middle and you send this to the rows, that's equivalent to this. So that's a little exercise to see that these two are, in fact, equivalent. OK, so here's a rough picture, again, due to me, in rank 2. So what are you supposed to do? You have so if I fix an underlying graph like this one and then I vary the lengths, then I'm just going to get a simplex. I'll get a two simplex, but the vertices of the simplex are not going to be in the space because being in the vertex means that I'm collapsing. I'm assigning length 0 to two of the edges, and that's not allowed. When I approach one of the edges of the triangle, then that means that I'm assigning a smaller and smaller number to that edge. And in the limit, the number is declared to be zero, and that corresponds to collapsing that edge to a point. Okay, so you're not allowed to collapse a whole loop to a point. Okay, so that's so for an underlying graph, you get a triangle like this, and then there's a natural way of gluing triangles together. If if I collapse a suitable edge here and a suitable edge here, I will get equivalent graphs, and then that means that these edges get glued together. And so you glue these triangles together, and this is the picture you get. That's you get this disk that's triangulated by ideal triangles like this. And then there's another shape of the graph, namely these the graphs with separating edges. And so those are triangles that have to be glued on top. So this triangle here is going to be glued to one of these edges in this picture, and it will be sticking out. Okay, so so Karen Bogman has a much better picture. I stole this from one of her papers. Now, what you should remember that the vertices are not in the picture, and also these edges of the triangles that are sticking out. Those are also not in the picture. Okay. And the main theorem about the space is that it is contractible. And why is that important? Well, because the group out Fn that we're interested in acts on it. And it acts on it in sort of the usual way by, in this case, post-composing by an automorphism. So you're given an automorphism of the free group, and you can think of it as a homotopy equivalence of the rows to itself. And so given a marked graph, you can post-compose it, and you get another marked graph. And that gives you an action. This action permutes the simplices, and so it's simplicial, and you can check all these other properties. It is discrete. It's not co-compact. But you can make it co-compact by passing to a smaller subspace called a spine. So any one of these simplices with missing vertices, or more generally, they're going to be simplices with missing faces. There's a natural spine of each one of those simplices, and there's an equivariant deformation retraction from the full outer space to the spine. And you can see the spine over here. And here I ignored those triangles that are sticking out. And the action is co-compact on the spine. Okay, so in the 90s, for the most part, and maybe a little bit into the 2000s, there was this big activity of proving these results that are maybe standard in the case of mapping class groups and maybe arithmetic groups, using this technology, using outer space and using train tracks. So maybe I will single out homological stability, because that came up before in the week. So for example, this is the theorem of Hatcher-Volkmann, that if you think of, you fix I, and you think about increasing n. So that here it's out, ought instead of out. That's because now we have an inclusion. But anyway, the homology stabilizes. Once the rank of the group becomes big enough, then the ith homology does not depend on n. And more recently, Galatius actually computed what it is, and amazingly, the rational homology is zero for every I. Okay. This T's alternative here was that was hard work. Okay. All right. Let's then keep going. There are questions. Okay. So now we get to the geometry part, which is really the main topic, the geometry of outer space. So again, this was motivated by Thurston. Thurston has so there are many metrics on Teichmuller space, but it doesn't seem like, most of them don't seem to generalize to outer space. But this one does. This is Thurston's metric on Teichmuller space. And the version for outer space goes like this. You're given two points in outer space. So there are two of these pairs. So there's gamma and there's gamma prime with their markings. And if there are different points, then I don't have a hope of finding an isometry here that makes this diagram commute up to homotopy. But I can try to do my best. Instead of seeking an isometry, I can try to find a map that minimizes the Lipschitz constant. Okay, so that's so let's say the minimal possible Lipschitz constant in this homotopy class of maps that that makes the diagram commute up to homotopy is sigma. Okay, so that's the smallest map. It's achieved. There is a map that realizes that Lipschitz constant by Arzelà Ascoli. And in fact, we can also restrict to maps. You should think of maps that are linear on edges. I don't want to do any sort of crazy thing on the edges because I can always make it linear, and then the Lipschitz constant in the process can only go down. Okay, so that's some number, sigma of gamma gamma prime. It's never less than one. If it's one, then you end up with an isometry, and it's typically bigger than one. And so you define the distance to be log of that number. Okay, so the distance from gamma to gamma prime is log of this number. And you can easily prove these properties here. So the triangle inequality holds, just because when you compose maps, the Lipschitz constant is submultiplicative. The Lipschitz, in general, the distance is not symmetric. Okay, so the distance from gamma to gamma prime is not equal to the distance from gamma prime to gamma. And here's an example. This is kind of an extreme example. You have this rose with lengths half. Each of these circles is length half. And this one here, think of x as being very small. Then when I go from A to B, I'm stretching by less than a factor of 2. You know, the left loop on the left goes to this loop that's less than twice the size, right? This is nearly 1, and this is a half, so the Lipschitz constant is less than 2. But if I go from B to A, then this tiny loop x has to stretch all the way to 1/2. And so the distance from B to A goes to infinity as x goes to 0. Okay, so the distance from this point in outer space to a point that's sort of close to infinity. When x becomes 0, then you're no longer in outer space. You're now at one of these missing vertices. So you pay a finite amount of money to go nearly to the end of outer space, but then it's very expensive to come back. So if somebody offers you a deal, you know, to take it to outer space, ask about the return ticket. This is the so it's far from being symmetric. However, there is a theorem of Hendel and Mosier that says that if you restrict this metric to the spine, then it is quasi-symmetric. In other words, this distance is uniformly bounded. So you cannot get ratios like this. It stops being geodesic, exactly. Yeah. So the geodesic between two points in the spine might take you near infinity in outer space. Right. Okay. So the basic theorem of Thurston is that if you, so in fact, instead of reading that whole thing, this is the summary, the one line summary. Suppose you have an optimal map between two hyperbolic surfaces, in other words, a map that minimizes the Lipschitz constant, then the lines of tension form a geodesic lamination. In other words, if you wiggle the map suitably, then you can assume that, so there's this geodesic lamination, and along the lines of this lamination, the stretch is by some factor lambda. And in the complement of the lamination, the Lipschitz constant is strictly less than lambda. Okay, so the lines of tension form a geodesic lamination. In outer space, or if the corresponding theorem for graphs is that the lines of tension form a train track. Okay, so here's an example. So you're supposed to imagine sort of the obvious map here. So this vertex goes maybe to the middle of this vertex, the horizontal edge here, and then the left green goes left, and then goes around this loop, and then comes back, and likewise for the loop on the right, and then this middle loop just goes to the middle loop here. Okay, so if you think about this, then the Lipschitz constant on the green loops is 2, and on the black loop it's 1. Okay, so the Lipschitz constant for this map is 2, and you cannot do better than 2 because you can see that that any legal path. So there's some kind of an obvious implied train track structure here. I'm allowed to, when I approach from the left, I'm required to go right. I'm not allowed to make the sharp turn. Okay, so the lines, so everything that passes from left to right is legal. So all legal lines get stretched by a factor of 2. Okay, so this is sort of a natural notion here. Okay. Okay, so here I want to give a little proof of the existence of train track maps. That this was not our original proof, but it is kind of in the spirit of what Thurston does. In fact, it was inspired by Baer's proof of Thurston's classification. Okay, so the basic logic is that you have this automorphism that you want to consider, and you would have, ultimately you'd like to prove that it has a train track representative. And you look at I guess it's called phi here. This automorphism is called phi. So you look at the displacement function. So given a point in outer space, you look at the distance between that point and its image under the automorphism. So the automorphism is acting by some sort of isometry on outer space. And you look at the distance from a point to its image. And there are logically, there are three possibilities. It could be that the infimum of this displacement function, capital phi, is zero, and it is realized. That is to say, there is a fixed point. If there is a fixed point, then since the stabilizers of points are finite, that means that the phi has finite order. So that's kind of the easy case. The second case is that the infimum is positive and is realized. Okay, so that's the case when we hope to find a train track representative. And this requires some fiddling around, but it is you have most of the ingredients already because you call it gamma. So this minimizer here, and you apply this theorem about train track. That comes with the with the optimal map, the ones that records the lines of tension to the map that here you have from gamma to phi of gamma. So there is this natural difference of markings map from gamma to phi of gamma, and that theorem hands you a certain train track on gamma or maybe on some subgraph of gamma. But you show that if it's a subgraph, then this map phi is reducible. That subgraph is somehow going to be invariant, and so the subgraph gamma zero that carries these the lines of tension is the whole graph. So you have now a train track structure on the graph, and you have to now fiddle a little bit to show that in fact that you can promote that to a train track map. But it's not very hard. I think the whole proof is maybe less than a page. And then the last case is that the infimum is not realized, whether it's zero or not. This is actually very similar to what we saw yesterday in Shishikura's talk, where you take a minimizing sequence and you where the distances converge to the infimum, and you argue that the projections have to leave every compact set, the projections to serve the moduli space. That's by some sort of compactness argument. Yeah, if they stayed in some sort of a compact set, then by limiting, you could find a graph that, in fact, where the displacement is equal to d, and you're assuming that doesn't exist. And so this leaves every compact set. And so what does that mean? Well, that means that there's going to be some kind of a very small loop in the graph. It'll have to look like. Well, I have it on the next slide here. No, I did, where is it? Thought I had the picture somewhere. But anyway, it'll look like this. And there's some kind of a tiny part over here, and then there's a big part like that. That's the only way you can be leaving every compact set in the moduli space. And so that's but on the other hand, the stretch is bounded. It's close to D. So that's going to imply that these little loops the little loops have to be mapped to the little loops. They're not big enough to be mapped to big loops. And so that'll give you an invariant subgraph, and it'll show that the automorphism is not irreducible. And this is somehow the schematic. Oh, there is the little graph. The schematic of what happens. So this first case is the elliptic case, where there is a fixed point. The second case is the hyperbolic case. And you really only have dots. You have the orbit of gamma. Those are sort of dots. But it turns out you can connect them in a more or less canonical way using these folding paths that really go back to Stallings. If you have a graph, you can easily produce a deformation in outer space by taking, say, two edges and then identifying, say, the segment of length epsilon on each with each other. Now, when you do this, the total sum of the lengths is no longer one, but you can rescale. And so those operations lead to paths in outer space. And there's a sort of canonical way of doing it when you have a train track map, and that gives you a whole line where the displacement is minimized. And this is an example of an axis. Now, unfortunately, axes are not generally unique, but they exist in these hyperbolic automorphisms. And then this is the schematic for the last case, the parabolic case, where you have these tiny graphs. So what happens is that you're going off to infinity. Okay, so we talked about the axes. So the irreducible automorphism has an axis. And then maybe the first glimpse that there is something hyperbolic going on was a theorem of Algonquin-Fier, that these axes are, in fact, if the automorphism is fully reducible, the axes are strongly contracting. So what that means is that for example, in a hyperbolic plane, you have if you here's a hyperbolic plane and you have an axis or a line, a geodesic, and you take any ball that's disjoint, metric ball that's disjoint from this line. So here's one. That's a pretty big ball. And look at the projection, nearest point projection of that ball. Well, no matter how big the ball is, as long as it's disjoint from the line, the image is always going to have a bounded diameter. Because there's kind of the worst ball you can draw, namely the one that's a horrible. And that one still has a finite projection. And the same thing works in outer space if you take this axis of a fully reducible automorphism and you project any metric ball disjoint from it, you will get something uniformly bounded. And the analogous theorem was proved by Minsky in Teichner space a long time ago. And so, for example, the consequence is that these axes are Morse, just like what we saw in the first slide, in the free group. So they have to track a geodesic. So if you take a quasi-geodesic joining two endpoints of this of the axis, that quasi-geodesic has to stay in the uniform neighborhood of the axis. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about very recent developments. And there were many. Okay, so there are complexes associated to OutFN, just like Harvey's curve complex is associated to mapping class groups. And there are two canonical ones, at least two. There are actually more, but I will only talk about two. The first one is the complex of free splittings. Okay, so the idea is just to add the missing faces to outer space. So, for example, in this configuration here, we had to remove the vertices because those were not represented by finite graphs. But now we're going to put them back in. Okay, so here's a missing vertex. And it's going to be represented by this graph where this point was squished to, where this the other loop was squished to a point. And this picture is supposed to represent the quotient of the Bassert tree associated to some action of the free group. And so that kind of action is called a splitting. It's a splitting of the free group over the trivial subgroup. Another way to think about this is to use a complex, the complex of spheres. So you're in the stream manifold, connected sum of S1 cross S2s, which are represented here by handlebody. You're supposed to think about doubling this whole picture. So if you double the handlebody, you'll get the connected sum of two copies of this. And this disk gets doubled to a sphere. And the dual graph is exactly this. So this this graph is sort of the dual graph to that sphere in this three manifold. Okay, so here's Karen's picture again, but now you're supposed to put the vertices back in. And you use the simplicial metric now. So you think of this as being a simplicial complex, and you take the simplicial metric. So you're just counting the number of edges that it takes to go from one vertex to another. So you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or something. Okay. Yes, they're all in. So this is the simplicial completion. So all the missing faces are put in.
Yes, but on the end, before you do the completion, are the edges of the yellow triangle?
The edges are not in. No, before you do that, they're not in because that this edge amounts to collapsing one of these loops.
Okay, that's what I wanted.
Yeah.
So you have to add those in as well. Yeah.
Okay, and then the other one is the complex of free factors. So this is somewhat more analogous to the Bruhat-Tietz building, where you take, instead of taking a vector subspace as representing a vertex, you take a free factor. So a subgroup is a free factor if the big group Fn is the free product of your subgroup and some other subgroup. Okay, and then simplices are flags. So if you and this is all up to conjugacy. So it's the vertex is really a conjugacy class of proper free factors, and the simplex is a flag. In other words, it's a nested collection of these free factors, and you're allowed to conjugate to make them nested. So if they're representatives of the conjugacy class, that they're nested. And here I do, this is not really a valid picture, because in rank 2 this complex is discrete. So this is kind of analogous to the curve complex of the punctured torus, where you have to modify the definition to get a reasonable picture. And so here the convention is that if a vertex is really a rank 1 factor represented by something like this, and then you join two of them if they together form a basis of the group. And then you get the Fairey graph. Okay. And then a few years ago, the theorem was that the theorem is that that both of these complexes that I described are hyperbolic, and so for the splitting complex this was proved by Hendel and Mosier, and for the free factor complex by Mark Fain and myself. And it's also understood which automorphisms act hyperbolically on these complexes. So you could say in either case this whatever the answer is, that's analogous to being pseudo-Anosov. And so in the case of complex of free factors, the answer is exactly fully reducible. So from that point of view, fully reducible is the right analog of being a pseudo-Anosov. For the splitting complex, the answer is a little more complicated, so I won't say what it is. But there are more. So this splitting complex is freer, so there are more elements acting hyperbolically. Now, how do you how does one prove that something is hyperbolic? Well, this is. That was also kind of a long story, and I think it started with Mazur and Minsky, who used it to prove that the curve complex is hyperbolic, and then it evolved over the years. And this is somehow the strongest theorem to date. It's somehow the assumptions are pretty weak. I mean, how do you can to check the definition that something is hyperbolic is too hard, because you have to check that all geodesic triangles are thin, but you don't really know what geodesics look like. You don't know when something is a geodesic. To prove that some graph, say, is hyperbolic, you only have to produce, for any two vertices, you have to produce a connected set, which you think of as being a geodesic, but it doesn't have to be. Any connected set that contains those two vertices. Okay, so that's L of XY. And then the main condition that it should satisfy is the thin triangle. So if I take three vertices and I draw these sets, so these are some blue sets, they're just connected sets. They have to satisfy the thin triangle. So this is the theorem of Bowditch. And then the other one is that if the two vertices are within distance 1, then these sets should be uniformly bounded.
What's the quantifier on Z?
For every X, Y, and Z.
No. For every X, Y, and L.
For every X, Y, and Z. Yeah, there's only one. So L of... No, so for every x and y, you have L of xy. And then this first bullet here is that for all x, y, and z, this is true.
Where does z, y, and z are the vertices of that
triangle? Z is any vertex in the graph. X, y, and z are any three vertices in the graph. So these three points are x, y, and z. And you can pick them anywhere you like. And then L of xy is supposed to be contained in the h neighborhood of L of xz and L of zy.
So the question is, does the quantifier come with the xy for all
no.
xyz, or does it come after the choice of L?
It comes after the choice of L.
You choose L before z. So for any two points x and y, you have to have L. L of xy.
L is a function.
L is a function. L is a function that depends on x and y. And then the property has to be that for any x, y, and z, you have this. You have to test all x, y, and z.
Right.
You have to test all terms.
After the bullet, you have L already. Right?
Yes.
Now, you have all x, y, no. You have
Okay. All triangles are thin, and these are funny. These are L triangles, triangles formed by L sets. Okay. Okay. So there are coarse maps, but from outer space to the complex of splittings to the free factor complex. So the action on S is freer than the action on F, and it's defined just like this. So you take a point in outer space, and it's some kind of a graph. Well, you can pick an edge, for example. Well, you can view it as a point of Sn if you want. I mean, strictly speaking, CVn is contained in Sn. But what I like to do is replace it by one edge splitting. So pick one of the edges and collapse all the others. So here I'm collapsing the middle edge and the right edge. And that gives me some kind of a graph, and then there's a vertex group, which you can forget the graph and just remember the vertex group. That's the map from the splitting complex to Fn.
So I should just mention that the criterion of theorem.
Okay. So sorry. So. Okay. So it's a point. All right. So Sol points out that this criterion is really due to him and to Howie Mazur.
Well, no.
My original proof is incorrect, and Ryan. It appears before his paper, in my paper, but the proof is in him.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. So there were, from the point of view of the sphere complex, and the corresponding paths were defined by Hatcher using surgery on spheres, this proof of hyperbolicity was given by Horbez and Hillian. Okay, so now we have the large scale geometry about Fn, and this is really something of current interest to me. And it's modeled on the Mazur-Minsky theory for mapping class groups. Okay, so the main thing is there's the notion of a projection. If I give you two free factors, say A and B, and they have to be in suitable general position, then I can define a certain canonical splitting. Well, within a bounded distance, you know, with the ambiguity of finite bounded diameter set in the splitting complex of A. So this B is somehow what maybe is unexpected, but this B determines a canonical splitting of A to within some bounded ambiguity. And the construction is roughly like this. You have this, you give yourself a graph where this B is represented by a subgraph. In other words, you have to choose a complementary factor, which I'm calling B perp here. So there are, of course, many choices for the B perp. And then you take a covering space corresponding to this A that you're given. And that's some kind of, it's a finite graph together with infinite trees attached. And you can throw away the infinite trees, and then this A gives you a splitting of A, as before. You can, for example, just take a one edge splitting by collapsing all the other edges there. And what you have to prove is that this doesn't depend on the choice of this perp. But it doesn't, at least in the presence of this general position. And then since then, Sam Taylor has a version of this theorem where this general position is very explicit. It's really analogous to surfaces having, say, intersecting boundaries or something. They shouldn't be disjoint, and one shouldn't be contained in the other. That's sort of thing. If you just want to determine a canonical free factor of A, then this notion of general position is much more natural. In any case, you can then organize these projections. So that you have this notion of a projection. You can organize into a big space. So you take an infinite collection of these free factors. They're all in mutual general position with each other, and those are the red blobs. So they're all hyperbolic spaces. And then there's a way to connect them up in a tree-like way, or more precisely, in a quasi-tree-like way. But think of it as a tree. So that if you pick any two of them, like for example, here's the one that's associated to A, and here's one that's associated to B. There's in this hyperbolic space, there is a natural nearest point projection. You can just follow this kind of geodesic over here. And the first point you hit in this S of A is going to be within a bounded distance from this construction that I gave you, so this projection of B to A. Okay, so this is some kind of a big space, and it is hyperbolic. And it turns out you can also divide all the free factors into finitely many classes, so that within each class, any two are in general position. Okay, so then this leads to these theorems. So for the mapping class group, you get that the mapping class group acts on the product, so that on the product of hyperbolic spaces, finitely many hyperbolic spaces, so that an orbit map is a quasi-asymmetric embedding. This is sort of a dream. We don't have that for RFM. We would like to have that for RFM. Because mapping class groups are not hyperbolic, and they're not going to act like this on a single hyperbolic space, but this is kind of the next best thing. And we feel like this is, you know, it's a good thing to have that. But we don't have it for the, so for out FN, at the moment, we only have a weaker theorem that says that out FN acts on the product of finitely many hyperbolic spaces, so that every exponentially growing automorphism has positive translational length. So we don't really know what to do with the ones that grow polynomially. And this is maybe the main question that we, take the simplest possible automorphism. This is the analog of a Dane twist. Can you find some sort of a hyperbolic space where out FN or maybe a finite index R group acts so that this element has positive translation length? Now, I don't have time to talk about the boundary and the random walks. So in fact, I have this sort of list of kind of questions that I had at the end. And a couple of weeks ago, Horbez posted a paper with these theorems. And so I had to move the question, so now it became a slide. And anyway, so Poisson boundary of RFN is the boundary, the Gromov boundary of the free factor complex. That's the main theorem. And then I will just leave these questions up. So thank you very much.
Before we ask questions, I want to point out the announcement on the board. Presenters and speakers should meet with Sam in G44 to take care of business. So I want to do that before you left. Now, it's up here to the left, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Yes.
It's room number in this building. Okay, questions?
Are there other complexes besides outer space on which action has been investigated?
There are other complexes that are like the splitting complex. You can consider splittings over cyclic subgroups, for example, instead of the trivial subgroup. And that one has also been shown to be hyperbolic by Brian Mann. There is also a complex that was defined by Patrick Reynolds, it was shown to be hyperbolic by Patrick Reynolds. It's very similar to the splitting complex, but it's set up so that automorphisms of free groups that come from surfaces, if they come from a homeomorphism of a once punctured surface, then those are not going to be hyperbolic. So it's always annoying to deal with those, and so you'd modify the complex to make it to make these guys elliptic, and that complex is also hyperbolic. There are probably others. There seems to be a lot of choices, but for now we'd like to understand those two. Yes.
Do you think there's a metric analog to the Peterson Bay metric on the on RFN, which we did with the points of infinity and finiteness?
The metric, the one I showed you, that does have features of the Weil-Peterson metric in this sense, but I don't.
It seems to me that the one that you presented had the features of the Pike-Miller metric.
Well, it has both. It has both. It's sort of a funny thing, but the being finite distance from a point at infinity.
Complete.
It is not complete. So actually, it's complete in the backwards direction. So what is a Cauchy sequence? You can define a Cauchy sequence by measuring the distance from xn to xm, where m is bigger than n, or you can do it the other way around. So in one direction it's complete, in the other direction it's not complete.
Yeah, I'm always symmetrized. It really does become complete.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know how to define any other reasonable. There are pressure metrics.
Maybe somebody else would talk about that, but I don't even know what to do with it.
You had this image earlier to your brother before about the backfield project for evolving. So when you have this not yet quite as good as an event in the project for evolving, can you, if you restrict this idea of what you're mapping class through, can you say anything nicer about that? Can you do the complexes that are?
So the one that I showed doesn't have the Dane twists. In the mapping class groups, we know how to make an action of a mapping class group, or maybe some finite index subgroup on the hyperbolic space where Dane twist acts hyperbolically. It has a non-trivial translation length. The ones I showed you don't have that. These automorphisms that grow linearly all have bounded orbits in all these projections, and so that's the main problem. Yes.
If you suspend an outer automorphism that stabilizes a geodesic, can you say something about the resulting two complex?
That's a good question. No, but that's something that should be studied. Yeah, it should be hyperbolic or something.
It should be hyperbolic.
Could you repeat the question?
If you take an automorphism that is hyperbolic, so it has an axis, and then you form a two complex. Basically, over a point, there's a sort of tautological two-complex. Over a point, you have a graph, and so as you go along the geodesic, along the axis, these graphs are changing. So that whole thing is a two-complex. Actually, Lee had a paper about this. That was a long time ago, though, so I don't remember. I had that slide up. That's.
You might be thinking about my students' thesis.
Yeah, I know. So obviously.
But in any case, the question, I mean, logical proposed the question is that two complex hyperbolic? I mean, is it universal complex? Yes, that's true.
Can I
let's thank the speaker again.